Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God. We're going to start the program with a new feature. It's going to be the Gaffney Brief. It's just a minute long, but it gives you an update on and insights into some of the current developments that I think are important for all of us to take attention. To pay attention to. This one is about the effective decision of the Supreme Court of Colorado yesterday to convict Donald Trump without a trial of involvement in incitement to have an insurrection back on January 6th, 2021. There was no proper proceeding here, but effectively they've used that finding to banish him from the primary ballot for the Republican election coming up this spring in Colorado. He will not appear on that ballot if the Supreme Court of Colorado has its way. It may not in the end, because presumably the appeal that Donald Trump is going to make to the Supreme Court of the United States will be heard, and I think have reason to believe it will be reversed there. But the key point here is that the evidence that there was any insurrection, let alone that Donald Trump was responsible for it, is becoming more and more suspect. And that means especially the conclusions and the conduct, for that matter, of the January 6th committee, as it was called, in the House of Representatives, a very partisan affair arranged and conducted to the dictates of Nancy Pelosi. A congressman who was formerly a police officer with a lot of experience in his native state of Louisiana in forensics and, criminal contending with criminal activity is Clay Higgins. And he had a fascinating interview recently with Laura Logan, in which he very strongly contended that what actually was taking place on January 6th was not an insurrection. Yeah, there were a lot of people there, and some of them behaved badly. But he points the finger very squarely at the FBI for what it seems to have done to contribute to that melee that took place, an inside job, in other words. And it's high time that this be firmly and fully investigated, and if indeed there was wrongdoing on the part of the authorities, they must be held accountable. We're going to turn next to our friend Elaine Donnelly, who has joined us. She is, of course, the president of a fabulous organization, the Center for Military Readiness. I strongly encourage you to take a look at her work, as well as support it at cmrlink.net. Her organization is critically important, especially to the problem that we find afflicting our military at the moment, and that would be the extent to which it is being, well, made over, I believe, in a Marxist image. And Elaine, I'm so grateful to you for all that you do, but especially for your help in keeping track of what's happening. And I wanted to start by asking you about something you wrote about recently in connection with Tommy Tuberville's efforts to make sure that senior military leaders are not actually being promoted when they support this kind of Marxist makeup.
Right.
Welcome back.
Well, Senator Tuberville was a real profile in courage, and he took so much heat for standing up to the Pentagon that decided to make its own policy with regard to abortion travel subsidies. And for that, he was subjected to all sorts of abuse and betrayal by some of the Republicans in the Senate, overwhelming opposition in the media and so on. He still stood his ground until the threat came from Republicans as well as Democrats to change the rules permanently in a way that would have really been problematic in the Senate. Then and only then did he
diminish minority rights.
Yes, it would have been disastrous. And so he did yield. The officers, most of them, as I understand it now, are confirmed or will be confirmed. Some of them, as you have highlighted very closely, shouldn't even be considered for high positions because they are so thoroughly engrossed in CRT, diversity, equity, inclusion, wokeism of the most extreme kind. And what is wokeism? It means taking progressivism to extremes and pose it with coercion, even if it hurts the institution. These guys really believe this stuff, and they're going to be promoted. It's going to take another generation, just like it took a generation to get us where we are now, to undo some of this stuff. Now, here's where...
If indeed we can.
If we can. Now, Congress can. Yeah. I've been, in the last several days, doing an in-depth study of what came out of the negotiations on the Defense Authorization Act for 2024. They got the bill passed. It's going to be signed into law. And what you see here are, it's one missed opportunity after another. There are some good things in the bill. You can tell that it must have been difficult for the true conservatives on the conference committee to work with this because they had to yield to the Senate 817 times, whereas the Senate yielded to the House only 481 times, almost double. So they were fighting, but they got overwhelmed time after time after time. And why is that? Because votes matter, elections matter, leadership matters. And in this case, the Senate and the Democrats predominated. They have a few concessions in
there. And they were doing the bidding, let's be clear,
of the administration. Absolutely. Yeah, in fact, everything that was taken out, and there was quite a bit of good items were taken out, they were targeted by the administration as being opposed, and they wanted them out. Number one on that issue, on that list, the abortion travel issue. When Senator Tuberville was forced to retreat on his stand, what they should have done was pass the House measure saying that defense funds should not be used for travel subsidies for abortion. Okay, there is no such law right now. There are some that are similar. The policy as put in place by the Pentagon is not consistent with the law, but there is no actual law addressing that travel issue, and they could have passed the House version, but of course they did not. On the transgender issue, same thing, transgender surgeries. I'm concerned about travel to have transgender surgeries. Since the Pentagon has gotten away with abortion travel, why not transition travel, even for children? They missed the opportunity to fix that. One of our priorities, meritocracy in the military.
If I may just interrupt you, Elaine, just quickly. When you say missed the opportunity to fix it, there actually was language, as I recall, in the House version of the National Defense Authorization Act that they could have made the ultimate outcome here. But in cases like this, as you say, the House receded.
Right. Time after time after time on the high button issues or high profile issues, House receipts, House receipts, House receipts. In a few cases, for instance, banning of critical race theory, you may have heard that did pass. There was actually several provisions in the House bill to deal with critical race theory. But guess what? There's a little loophole here, which is pretty big. It says, yes, we're going to ban critical race theory instructions at the service academies. However, we will protect academic freedom to teach. Now, here's the problem. Why are these people marching in the streets in favor of Hamas? It's a derivative of critical race theory ideology. We're seeing it at Harvard, the elite universities, the Ivy League, and they're dividing people into oppressed and oppressors. And in this case, the Jewish people who were attacked on October 7 are considered the oppressors. Now, that's academic
Elaine,
freedom.
Let me ask you to hold. Yeah, it's abusive.
Yes,
as you say, in fact, coercive. It's not freedom at all, as it is applied particularly in the military. Elaine, we're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back with more and other aspects of this National Defense Authorization Act. I call it the Not Defending America Act. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Colorado Supreme Court effectively convicted Donald Trump yesterday of inciting an insurrection 3 years ago. It was on that basis that 4 of 7 justices blocked the former president's name from appearing on next year's Republican primary ballot. But Mr. Trump has not been prosecuted, let alone convicted, on charges of precipitating or otherwise engaging in insurrectionist activity. And the kangaroo court proceedings of the Congressional January 6th committee that some argue amounts to such an indictment are increasingly discredited. Notably, veteran police officer turned Representative Clay Higgins affirmed to journalist Laura Logan on the basis of his own and others' ongoing forensic work that, far from being an insurrection, what happened on January 6th appears to have been an inside job engineered by the FBI and others. Before his voters are disenfranchised, Donald Trump must have his day in the Supreme Court. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we're continuing a really important conversation with Elaine Donnelly of the Center for Military Readiness. She is one of the really duty experts, as far as I'm concerned, on something that she describes as the culture of the military. And it's an intangible thing for many of us, particularly who have not served in the uniform, but it's vital to understanding whether the military is in fact going to be able to perform its singular mission, which is defending our country against the enemies that now abound. We'll be talking more about all of the abounding of it with Colonel Grant Newsom in a moment. But Elaine, I did want to ask you to continue to lay out the decisions that were made to have the House recede, and you talked about some 800 times. I assume some of those times were on things that were not related to these.
Oh, yes. That's the entire bill.
Culture and military, policy positions. But the ones that are particularly concerning, especially given that we now have all of these officers imbued with critical race theory and diversity, equity, inclusion, the whole Marxist, agenda, really, how critical it is that we get the policies right.
So
that's
right.
It's made clear that that's not actually what we want for our military. So carry on with your analysis of this.
Yes.
As it stands now, please.
CRT, critical race theory, diversity, equity, inclusion, all go back to the paramount issue of this past year, meritocracy in the military. There were three Senate versions and one House, and they sort of mixed them together, and they took out a key word. The one that did get into the bill says that there shall be, that merit will be used in deciding who gets promoted or admitted and so on. Individual merit and demonstrated performance. That's the phrase that's used. But they left out the word exclusively. Now, if you take out the word exclusively, then you open the door, you leave the door open for things like race or other characteristics that are superficial and not important to the military to be just as important. So to take out the word exclusively.
Could I just ask? It was the word in the original.
It was in the Senate
so
bill.
Taking it out was deliberate and conscious.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. Now they did not include primarily. That was good because primarily could have been a loophole, similar loophole. And at first I didn't even notice that a friend brought it to my attention. The word exclusively is missing. Wait a minute. I mean, this was the same amendment that we had supported as the primary one that we favored. But when they took out the word exclusively, that really changed the meaning of it. Now, it opens the door for the Pentagon to continue discriminating on the basis of race. And there was another measure that
race
said
or
specifically,
gender or, sexual preferences or anything else.
Right. And making it worse, there was another measure that would have said explicitly the service academies, military service academies, may not discriminate on the basis of race. And they took that out of the House bill when they passed the conference
section.
So again, the Pentagon, they play games with stuff like this. They'll say, oh, yes, we consider merit. We consider this, that. But it's all in what weight do they give to these various things. They have something in there about test scores. This is good. You should use objective test scores in deciding who gets admitted to West Point. But when they leave out certain, they should have put language in there saying that it would have more weight. If they say, well, that's only 10% weight instead of 30%, you see where the result is. They still get to discriminate. Now, there's litigation filed to extend the Supreme Court decision to the service academies, but that'll take years. Again, a missed opportunity to end the racial discrimination that exists today.
Yeah, as you know so well, Elaine, what all of these amount to are distractions from the real purpose, the mission, as I said, of the military. Something, again, that you appreciate, and I guess most of us probably don't adequately, is there's a finite amount of time that a serviceman or woman, or I guess person who identifies otherwise, has to be trained. Mm-hmm. And if some portion of that training has to be assigned to pronouns or, you know, sexual identification preferences and, yeah, and CRT and all the rest of it, that's time not spent actually preparing for your job, your mission in the military, isn't it?
It is. Here's a very clever little thing somebody did. There is a measure in there saying we want to know how much time and money is being spent on critical race theory instructions. Oh, well, that sounds good. It's in the bill. But guess what? That measure expires as soon as a report is filed with Congress. It goes away. I mean, these little loopholes, the closer I look at this bill with a magnifying glass, hold it up to the light, when you see what's missing, you see the fine hand of the administration at work. And in a way, it kind of inspires me, and I hope it will inspire members of the Congress next year, to pick up everything that landed on the cutting room floor. I'm going to document every one of them. And that will be the agenda for next year, to improve what was passed and to add back what was left out. Because we have to do this.
We have to
military.
Do it. And again, Elaine, one of the things I so appreciate about the Center for Military Readiness is you really do speak for people who can't speak for themselves, by
no,
and large.
They can't.
Under military discipline, that's not an option. Let me ask you about one other issue. I don't know the truth to this, but I was informed the other day that as part of this integration of the transgender individuals into the armed forces, it is now the case that they not only have to have all kinds of dedicated support for their surgical procedures and hormone treatments and psychological counseling and all the rest of it, because they're basically psychologically disordered, let's face it.
They're dependent on medication,
right?
Yes.
And dependent on medication.
Lifelong.
So, but the point is that I was told is that when they deploy, such individuals have to have a kind of logistical tail to support them, you know, when they're on ships or in the field. I don't know if you can comment on the veracity of this, but I mean, it sounds right to me. If the whole point is you have to show that these people are deployable, are still able to serve, wouldn't it make sense that the military's view that they have to be supported intensively and very expensively at other stages of this process would apply to the field as well?
Well, that may be something that is going on that I've not heard of yet. It's very difficult to find out exactly what's going on. But we do know that during the Obama administration, there was travel. The expenses were very high for the people who came out as transgender toward the end of the Obama administration. The costs were so high, in some cases, it cut into maintenance and other operational funds. So we need to know exactly how much money is being spent. But what is more likely is those personnel will not even be deployed, because every time you have surgery, leading up to it, you have something called real life experience, where you go and pretend like you're the opposite sex and see if you like it or not. And then, of course, recovery time after major surgery, very expensive surgeries. So a lot of people become non-deployable at all. Now, there is one little ray of hope here. The House has a measure in there that says they want all the details about costs and also disruptions involving women having to sacrifice their privacy with men coming in, using their showers, invading their athletic teams. This is a measure that calling for a report on these very subjects. Now, it's going to be very interesting to see what they come up with. And I hope they come up with the truth for a change, because it's all kind of shrouded in secrecy.
I'm not going to count on it, Elaine, but this is where you come in at the Center for Military Readiness. You have an extraordinary ability to get to the truth and make sure the rest of us are exposed to it. And we thank you for that.
Thank you.
Especially because you are giving voice to what our men and women in uniform, real men, real women in uniform especially, are unable to say and do for themselves. Keep up the great work at the Center for Military Readiness. If I got that right, cmrlink.net?
No, .org.
.org, excuse me. cmrlink.
cmrlink.org, right.
There we go. Check it out, folks. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man who distinguished himself not only in the uniform of the Marines, but also as a foreign service officer in our embassy in Tokyo for two stretches, as I understand it. He is a man who has also been a successful businessman in the Western Pacific, and all in all, a very, informed individual about what is happening in that part of the world. He is the author most recently of an important book, When China Attacks. And it's the subject to which I want to turn immediately with him. Colonel, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
No, glad to be here. Thanks.
I wanted to talk with you about a very interesting conversation that I had with one of our valued colleagues, Gordon Chang. He and I spoke earlier in the week about his assessment that the Chinese Communist Party is not actually ready to go to war over Taiwan, or it seems really further to project power at this point. I went over with him some of my thoughts on the subject, but I'm anxious to get yours. Your book, of course, makes pretty clear that this is an event that is likely to emerge at some point. The question is it perhaps a year or two off, or do you think it's much closer at hand?
Oh, well, I think it could happen anytime. The Chinese have built up a military which has all the parts, you know, the air, sea, ground capabilities, plus long-range missiles, outer space operations. very effective cyber and electronic warfare capabilities. And so they've gradually put together the pieces that they need. They've trained for it. And as importantly, they are getting the country ready to sanctions. They're sanctions proofing it so that they can withstand the pressure that they know would come in the event of a war. But in terms of just, you know, giving the People's Liberation Army the order to take Taiwan, they could do it. And in fact, I've seen some pretty good assessments from a decade ago, which suggested they had the ability to get, say, 40, 50,000 troops across the strait in one day. And that was 10 years ago. So this is really one mission for which that military has trained for the last 20, 30 years. And it's had it in mind for the last 50, at least. And I think they could do it. Of course, we won't know till we know, but if you look at them in operation, look at what they have showed they can do. And I would not bet against it. They might have reason to think that they can.
And Colonel Newsom, you know something about amphibious operations, of course, from your time in the Marine Corps. But one of the things that it does seem is a factor, and I'd be interested in your thoughts as to how much of a factor it is. Gordon Chang pointed to a lot of turmoil inside the military. He noted that the country has been without a defense minister for a number of months, that two of the senior-most generals in the rocket forces that, you know, are, you know, a key part of the nuclear deterrent, and some 70 other officers has apparently been cashiered. And we spent a lot of time trying to suss out what that all means in terms of Xi, of his control, whether his people are now being put in or people that are more aligned with his view that war is in fact necessary, or whether, you know, what's coming to the fore now are people who are not agreed with him, or whether this is just simply paranoia. I think those were the three basic, you know, possibilities as Gordon saw it, but all of which he felt strongly indicated that whatever the material state and readiness and, you know, preparations that have been put into place, the exercises, you've been monitoring them closely, I know, that this is determinative of whether the nation could, in fact, go to war in the near future or not. Your thoughts?
Well, it could be. I don't think anybody quite knows. You know, I would note that every military, just about anywhere, particularly in these kind of regimes, it has problems. They're never as good as they're billed to be, or as good as they say they are. So these sorts of personnel difficulties, they're not so unusual for a regime like this. You know, you could indeed interpret it as a sign that that it reflects a broader chaos and unrest in the military, such that Xi Jinping would not try to attack anybody. Or you could just say it's one of those things. You know, he's getting his guys into place, or they've had some problems and they're correcting them. But overall, as I said, when you look at what this People's Liberation Army is capable of, in different domains, in different areas, that I'm afraid that they've got all the pieces together. And also keep in mind that it isn't just a reprise of Normandy 1944, but rather you've now got much more effective long-range weaponry. China's had 50 years to get its targeting down right. You have the ability to move troops by helicopter, which you didn't have in 1944. Also, don't forget the Chinese efforts to soften up Taiwan, and the fifth column in Taiwan is immense. And I wouldn't be surprised if some ports and airfields were opened up for the Chinese. So I say you put all this together, and I'm very concerned. You know, I understand the debate on the position on the other side, but that's how I come down on this. You know, I would not underestimate these people.
Yeah, you know, Gordon, I don't think has had your experience. He's had a lot in China and, of course, monitoring it. But one of the things that I know you've had firsthand understanding of as a result of your service in uniform and working with, you know, our intelligence community is you need to focus on capabilities not intentions. Intentions can change very rapidly. The capabilities are the things that are really determinative and, you know, take longer to put into place. And I take it from what you've said, Colonel, both today and in the past and in your book, of course, when China attacks, those capabilities are now established. They can always be improved, and I'm sure the Chinese are going to continue to improve them. But the basic wherewithal required to mount such an amphibious assault on Taiwan, should it come to that, is now basically in place. Am I reading you right?
I'm afraid so. You know, I think they've got the pieces in place, and we've seen them really practicing it over the last 2 years. Sort of like a baseball team has the outfielders and the infielders practice separately, the pitchers and the catchers. And then one day they come together for a game. They're at about at that stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Game on, as they say. Let me ask you about one other issue that Gordon suggested that I frankly confess my geographic ignorance on this point. But he said there's an island in the Ryukyu chain extending down from the main Japanese islands called Amami, I believe it is, that is actually south of Taipei. And that if the Chinese were to try to undertake an assault on the island of Taiwan, they would have to impose a blockade, and the blockade would necessarily have to include inside of it this Japanese territory. And that would, in his thinking, mean that Japan would have to be involved in a war with Taiwan from the get-go, and that somehow would further, at this moment at least, discourage the Chinese from acting. To talk a little bit about that, you've spent a lot of time in Japan. You have, a very considerable understanding of how the Japanese see these things. They've made no secret that they would anticipate they would be involved in a war, but what do you think about this particular proposition?
It's likely that the Japanese would get hit in the event China goes after Taiwan. But as long as the Americans are around, that is really what causes the Chinese to think really hard about what they're going to do. If it was just the Japanese, the Chinese wouldn't hesitate. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Japanese actually found that they just couldn't do much. Unfortunately, the Japanese military is not ready to fight a war. Nobody can say this because it's not polite, but that's the reality. But as long as the Americans are there, Chinese are going to have second thoughts. But if it's just the Japanese, I don't think that's enough to really cause the Chinese to hold off.
Yeah, and we have to take a short break here in a moment. But one of the things that I want to get into with you is the calculation that the Chinese have of whether the United States will in fact be involved. And we've talked with you and many others, including in our wonderful series of Committee on the Present Danger China webinars, to which you have contributed greatly as one of our important members of that committee, about the, well, I call it the strategic arson that Chinese dictator Xi Jinping is engaged in now increasingly around the world, that has, it would seem, at least as one of its purposes, distracting, depleting the resources of and otherwise maybe even disabling the United States from rising to the challenge that now seems to be increasingly impending with respect to Taiwan. Colonel Newsham, we're going to come back to you in just a moment to talk a little bit about how that looks from your vantage point in the Western Pacific and what we better be thinking about its implications for deterring an attack against Taiwan that it certainly seems Xi Jinping has very much in mind. We'll be talking about all of that and more. Stay tuned with Colonel Grant Newsom right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Colorado Supreme Court effectively convicted Donald Trump yesterday of inciting an insurrection 3 years ago. It was on that basis that 4 of 7 justices blocked the former president's name from appearing on next year's Republican primary ballot. But Mr. Trump has not been prosecuted, let alone convicted, on charges of precipitating or otherwise engaging in insurrectionist activity. And the kangaroo court proceedings of the Congressional January 6th committee that some argue amounts to such an indictment are increasingly discredited. Notably, veteran police officer turned Representative Clay Higgins affirmed to journalist Laura Logan on the basis of his own and others' ongoing forensic work that, far from being an insurrection, what happened on January 6th appears to have been an inside job engineered by the FBI and others. Before his voters are disenfranchised, Donald Trump must have his day in the Supreme Court. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we are continuing a tremendously important, very topical, and very needed conversation with Colonel Grant Newsom, one of our forward-deployed observers as to what is happening in the Western Pacific, specifically the threat we face from the Chinese Communist Party in that region and beyond. And Colonel, I mentioned before the break that I wanted to talk with you about kind of the broader global picture, not just what might be in the offing, vis-a-vis Taiwan or others in the East Asian arena. What I've described as strategic arson, or even pyromania now on the part of Xi Jinping, is manifesting itself, I would argue, in Ukraine, yes, in Israel, yes, in the Arabian Sea and other parts of the southern Middle East, the waters there. And quite possibly beyond. Let me just ask you most specifically, as a man with considerable time at sea with the United States Navy as a Marine, what do you make of the attacks that are now taking place at the hands of the Houthi rebels, as they're called, Iran, is my view, and their implications, not just for sort of shipping and commerce in the region, but more broadly, sir?
Well, I think it shows that the Iranians are not scared of the Americans. And that is never a situation that you want to have, nor the Chinese. You know, the Chinese are obviously bolstering Iran, buying a ton of their oil, which is against our sanctions, at least, and international sanctions. And they're doing it anyway. And the Americans are even handing over billions of dollars to the Iranians. You heard that right. It is so unbelievably stupid. But what it really points out that they're not afraid of us, and the Chinese aren't either, and that gives them really just the, sort of the psychological wherewithal to move. And you're seeing them behaving aggressively in Latin America, in the Caribbean, throughout the continent, and Africa as well, and the Russians as well feel like they've got the free world and the United States on the back foot. And what you're going to see is them keep pushing and pushing and pushing. It's not as if they're going to get tired of it or back off, but until they have some reason to be frightened, they're going to keep moving. And the fact that these Houthis, of all people, are able to shut down the Red Sea, it ought to be an embarrassment for any U.S. administration to allow this to happen. But it shows just how supine they are when in the face of this sort of attack by our enemies. One hardly knows what to say. One hopes we can last another year.
Yeah. Well, again, the real concern is what seems not to be simply a lack of fear, but actual contempt for us. I would argue both on the part of the Iranians, very obviously, but also the Chinese, translates into being emboldened to act elsewhere. To the extent that we're now hearing the administration allocating some naval assets to a multilateral task force to try to protect this shipping. If there is shipping going to be going into that area any longer, it seems a little unclear whether everybody's now going, you know, around South Africa. But Colonel, that would seem to further tie down some of our very limited supply of warships at a moment when we might need them elsewhere, no?
No, it sure does. We don't have anywhere near the number of ships we need. And we have really gotten ourselves sort of wrapped around an axle in the Middle East. And now this Red Sea business happens. And yes, we don't have enough Navy ships in the Pacific as it is. And to go down to the Red Sea, and it really looks like what they're going to do is, sort of try and intercept arrows instead of going after the archer who's launching them. And, you know, so we spend $1 million or $2 million on a missile to knock down a drone that costs $500,000 at the most, probably a lot less than that. You know, this is a fool's errand that we're
if we can shoot it down, which is a whole nother question, whether this will be protected. But your point is so well taken. I mean, in another way of conveying to the Iranians that we're not serious about any of this, we are allowing the Houthis effectively to operate with impunity, and that can't be sustained, I don't think. Do you?
Oh, not at all. It's really, if we go there, we're not going to get to the root cause of this problem. We are kind of wasting our time. And as you've noted, there's other places where we need to be and be in force and frightening people. And when we're tied up in the Red Sea, we're not scaring the Chinese one bit. In fact, they are emboldened.
Right. One other manifestation of the ambitions of the Chinese, I think, is evidenced by the penetration of our southern and I think northern borders as well by numbers, tens of thousands specifically, of what are said to be, by trained observers, apparently Chinese People's Liberation Army Special Forces personnel. And this raises a concern that I have, and we've, again, discussed this in the past, but just your current thinking on it, Colonel, against the backdrop of everything we discussed is important. Is the home front likely to be a site of another conflagration if the Chinese are determined to take Taiwan, and to what effect?
Oh, there's only about 100% chance of it. I think you would find us sort of in chaos in the United States trying to deal with these attacks on key infrastructure, just attacks on people. And when you're trying to calm down the home front and take care of your enemies there, you don't have the resources, the attention to pay as you should where the bigger fight is taking place. Any time that you have allowed 10 million people to come in.
You may not be able to move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excuse me, but I just want to say, sabotage and the like may actually impede any mobilization that you might have.
Oh, yeah. And also,
finish that last point, because that's critical.
If you've let 10 million people into your country, you don't really know who they are. You're asking to lose. It's almost as if we want to lose. And no country could ever do this or has ever done it. Plus, keep in mind that we may laugh about China's power projection capabilities, but they've got freighters and ships all over the place with their commercial operations. Just put some anti-ship missiles on those and use drones, use your fishing fleet, and you could easily...
Colonel, hold the thought. We'll be right back with more with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We are visiting with Colonel Grant Newsom. He is a distinguished veteran of the United States Marine Corps and one of our real go-to guys on the whole issue of Communist China, the subject of his important new book, When China Attacks. And Colonel, you were just concluding, and I apologize for interrupting you, we just had a hard break there, on your thoughts about the home front as a theater in which we may well find ourselves engaged against an enemy that does have quite considerable power projection capability.
Yeah, you know, as we discussed, we'll be embroiled in just fighting in the United States. But also what I was getting at is that China's conventional power projection capability is limited at the moment if you get too far away from China. But keep in mind that their commercial tanker fleet, freighter fleet, this can easily be weaponized, and it probably is. And also they have a fishing fleet all over the place, a maritime militia. And if you do this right, you could put these in position where they could knock off a few dozen American ships without notice. And while we're looking for their surface combatants, they've actually weaponized their civilian maritime capabilities. And this is something that we're finally waking up.
Both the Russians. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I hope we are. Both the Russians and the Chinese have developed these containerized missile mm-hmm. systems that can be, from external observation at least, essentially indistinguishable from tens of millions of other containers mm-hmm. that are on board, in many cases, as you say, Chinese vessels. Chilling stuff. And we better be live to the dangers here on the home front, folks. This is why we've been calling for quite some time, including, among other places, in our book, The Indictment, which I commend you all at theindictmentbook.com, to put our nation on a war footing. We're going to need it. Colonel, lastly, let me turn quickly to something that you've reported on, again, from your perch in Japan. There are influence operations underway at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party that are likely to make our defense of the Western Pacific more difficult. Talk quickly about that, if you would, please, sir.
Sure. You have Chinese political warfare and subversion efforts in every Pacific island, every single one. There's three islands in particular, three nations, Palau, Marshall Islands, and Micronesia, that run right through the center of the Central Pacific. And they have special agreements with the United States that we give them aid and they let us take care of their defense. But the Chinese have very effectively used blandishments, bribes, Chinese people on the ground, actually, to create huge constituencies in both places that want to move away from the United States and towards China. And that potentially means that we won't have a secure rear area. So while we're defending on the very west of the Pacific, behind us, the Chinese are getting substantial inroads. And eventually you just might find we're not welcome, but the People's Liberation Army is. And this is even in what sort of our these key allies that we have, Marshall Islands in, as one worth noting, because you've had basically two Chinese nationals took Marshallese citizenship and came within one vote in the Marshallese parliament of setting up what amounts to a country within a country. And this was, it would have been a free trade zone. And it's very close to the American missile testing facility at Kwajalein. And the Americans have not done what they could to head this off. And what I would note is just that we deserve a failing grade for our inability to counter this Chinese subversion influence efforts throughout the entire Pacific.
This is just heartbreaking, Colonel. You and a few of others of our Committee on the Present Danger China have been warning about what's going on in these islands. As you know so well, sir, your branch of the armed forces bled massively to take those islands back from the Japanese, in a number of cases at least. And the idea that we might essentially blithely turn them over to them, especially on the cusp of what looks like another shooting war in the Western Pacific with a peer adversary, is essentially malfeasant and criminally so, in my judgment. Colonel, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I so appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us as always and for your great continuing service to our country. We'll talk with you again soon. Merry Christmas to you in the meantime. I did want to have just a new feature of this program, a closing comment on kind of an update on one of our stories we reported to you earlier, and that is the fate of a very beautiful memorial to the fallen in Arlington Cemetery. It is best understood, I think, by a large number of American presidents, not least, as a tribute to the reconciliation before the armies of the North and the armies of the Confederacy in the Civil War. And unbelievably, as part of the Marxist takedown of our history, the calculated effort to divide us, this testimony to what is, I think, a critical feature of our past history, namely finding a way to come together, e pluribus unum, as they say, out of many one, is now being dismantled in Arlington Cemetery. Judge has ruled that the destruction of that memorial, I think, is allowed to go forward, and we'll see if, in fact, it turns up in more or less one piece at Virginia Military Institute sometime soon. But the desecration of the hallowed ground of Arlington Cemetery is, I believe, a scandal, and unfortunately, just one more example of the inroads being made by Marxists in this country to the detriment of both our understanding of who we are as a people and our comportment as a society. We'll be watching this closely. We'll be continuing to report with you, but I did want to share this with you as an important update, and this will be a feature going forward of Securing America. I want to thank all of you for being with us. This is a program brought to you by our Center for Security Policy. We hope you'll support it at securefreedom.org. Press the button there for Securing America. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again next time, and that I hope, as always, that until then, you'll go forth and multiply.